Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
Don't hold anything too tightly. Just wish for it, want it, let it come from the intention of real truth for you, and then let it go.
For me, our soul is like, it's unbound, it's limitless, but we will use words to limit ourselves.
When people stop believing that somebody's got your back or Superman's coming, we turn to ourselves, and that's where you become empowered.
Courageous participation attracts positive things.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations. Because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Today is no exception. I'll let Elise fill you in on her extraordinary guest. All right, over to Elise.
Kevin Weinfurt is a professor and vice chair for research in the Department of Population Health Sciences in the Duke University School of Medicine. In his research, he works to understand the way illness, chronic disease, and other issues impact a person's sexual well-being. Today, we talk about how the definition of sex remains confusing and hard to pin down, and the ways that this impacts the research around it. We talk about the role that intimacy, like hand-holding, eye contact, and simple touching, plays in sexual wellness. And he explains the reason why clinicians who are treating patients with illnesses that affect sexual function aren't talking them through this discomfort, which often leaves them in the dark or to fend for themselves. He and his colleagues are working to fix that.
It was impressive how many measures were basically designed for sort of upper economic status, heterosexual married couples.
Yeah.
And the assumptions that were built into all the questions were so loud. And so one of the things that we really tried to do was to take a step back and say, how do we create a measurement system where we can allow people from all different backgrounds and different practices and orientations have their experiences reflected and tracked so that we can understand how their health problems are affecting whatever it is they're doing?
Okay, let's get to my chat with Kevin Weinfurt.
So obviously, sex is something that we have a particular interest in at Goop. What is sexual health? Not even what's normal, because I think we can clearly establish that there is no normal, but also sort of what's appropriate, how is it connected to our health? And no one has these conversations, right? And it seems like within your research, it's not even necessarily asked. And certainly when we're sick, it's discounted. But like, how essential or how important is it for our well-being?
Well, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking to people with a whole range of different chronic diseases, cardiac problems, arthritis, cancer. And you hear so many stories of the ways in which the disease and the treatments for the disease have impacted people's ability to engage in intimate activities. And, you know, for some people, it's not that big of an impact and it doesn't bother them that much. But for other people, it's absolutely devastating. You know, in addition to trying to deal with the disease they've got, they're also trying to deal with some relationship issues that may arise because, you know, they're just not interested anymore, or things aren't working the way that they wanted to. And it's hard for people to talk about those things.
Yeah, no, I'm not surprised. And I feel like the only glimpses of that conversation that we seem to see sort of socially or out there sort of openly in the news or reported on is sort of the side effects of prostate cancer, right? And men not wanting to be both potentially incontinent, but also to have erectile dysfunction. I mean, clearly there's a lot of conversation about that socially. And what does the research say? I mean, are men, is that fear of impotence more social, or is it sort of the way that they see themselves as a man? Is it both? Is the same true for women and it's just not talked about?
The men we've spoken to have come in with a lot of shame about erectile problems. Mm-hmm. And when you do a focus group, as soon as the first person starts to talk about it, everybody's kind of relieved and they all start talking about it. And just having a conversation with, you know, 8 to 10 strangers about this, who are all going through this, is incredibly therapeutic for them, even though this was a research focus group. You know, it's not unusual for people afterward to be exchanging emails and that. And so making a space for people to talk about this is important. And I think you're right, as you say, the prostate cancer issues and erectile function get a lot more attention. But we also heard a great deal of shame and difficulty associated with men for whom they don't really have a sexual drive anymore, or men who have trouble reaching an orgasm. One focus group that I ran, it was remarkable that all of the men in the focus group had at one time or another said that they faked orgasm, which is not something you usually think of guys doing. And while we make lots of jokes about women doing it and, you know, it's in sitcoms and that, the fact that they had to do that during lovemaking was a source of incredible shame for them.
Interesting. Even though theoretically, for men in particular, because it's so much easier and less complex, or at least that's the perception, you would think that it would be equally easy for them to be like, something biologically happening has nothing to do with you. Yet it's still, is the shame coming from their fear of rejecting or disappointing their partner, or is it coming from their own inability to quote unquote perform?
I would say in our research focus groups, the things that we tended to hear were some shame associated with me not being able to do what I'm supposed to be able to do as a man, and also profound discomfort with what effect this might be having on my partner. What's my partner thinking? What is going to happen if months are going by and I'm just not into it as I used to? Is he or she going to get frustrated and go do something else? These were some things people were expressing to us.
So interesting. I mean, even that quote, like even that line, as a man, because we have, I think for women, a very like pornographied or linear understanding of women and sex, but the same can certainly be true for men, right? And as a man, like, where does that even come from? Like, who is it porn? Is it, like, where do men, I mean, again, this is probably going way outside of the world of research, but like, where does their construct come from? Hollywood?
I think it's a great question. And I'm just speculating here, but yeah. I would say certainly the cultural milieu that we're in has a profound effect. What was interesting is, you know, we talked to lots of different groups of men, different ages, different socioeconomic backgrounds. And what's impressive is how little difference there is in some of these attitudes. I remember talking to a focus group of all older men. So these were men in their 70s, all of whom had some serious chronic conditions, all of whom had indicated that somehow that was affecting their sex lives. And you got them all together, and there was sort of this surface machismo that, oh, everything's fine, everything's great. You know, and I'd ask, how's your disease affected this aspect of your sex life? And say, oh, it's fine. And then you poke a little bit further, and people would start saying, well, yeah, there's this, and there's that, and there's... And so you'd hear that people sort of had this presentation that things were good. But then as you delved in, you found out, well, they're actually having some fairly profound difficulties, but that's different from this presentation. So
yeah, And how many of these men were in partnership either with other men or women? And how many of them were single? Because I would imagine that it would probably be far more crippling to be, or maybe not. I guess if you have no sexual desire, it's better. It might be easier to just navigate your illness alone. But if you have sexual desire and you can't perform however you think you're supposed to, how does that impact their lives as single men? I know that's five questions in one.
Right. But, well, most of the people we talked to were partnered. But one thing I would say that we learned from both men and women was that people who are not partnered also feel that their sexual being is a part of them. Mm-hmm. And even though right now they may not be using that in a partnered situation, it was still an important part of them for some people. And it was concerning that that part was affected.
And how did that manifest? Was that like, I just don't feel pleasure in my body, or I don't ever feel aroused or interested? Or what is that, like that sort of, that sexual energy sickness, or what does that look like?
In the people in our groups who were talking about this, that what I recall of the folks who were saying that, you know, having a strong libido was a part of me, and it's not there anymore, and it's worrying to me.
Yeah. And is that just like, what does that mean to have a strong libido? Is that just responding to sort of the world, visual, whatever you're attracted to, and then feeling your own body respond? Is that what it is? Or is it like they just, I used to have sex three times a week and now I don't, and that seems cognitively troubling, but I don't.
I think we heard a range of experiences that people had. You know, for some people, they were expressing dismay that they weren't getting turned on by things. There was just this animating energy that they used to have that was a part of them, that they identified with, that's no longer there.
Mm.
There were other people who talked about what a healthy sex life they had with their partner, and that was such a normal part of life. And to have this disease rob that from me is absolutely crushing. Similarly, there were some people who said, the one thing that's still intact is my sex life with my partner.
Mm.
And that has been an anchor during this disease process. I think this was some people with cancer who were talking about this. So it could go either way. If it's affected, it has a profound impact on people. If it's not affected, for those folks for whom a sexual life is foundational for their life, it's really the anchor that might get them through. It has tremendous meaning.
So interesting. And I just am always curious about whether people's experience of their sex life is shaped by sort of what, again, that animating force that you talked about, their own response, or whether it's shaped by cultural and like, how many times should I be having, like, what's normal? I think where everyone is consumed with this question of what's normal in terms of desire, frequency, style, whatever it is. So it's interesting to think about it in the context of whatever you anchored yourself to as normal, either not being there or being there.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something that was really interesting about some of our early work with patients who have cancer. And it says, you know, when you try to develop measures of these things, there are always places where you can't do it well. And those are the interesting places to me. You know, measuring erectile function, we can do that pretty well, but we heard some people talking about their satisfaction with their sex life. And for many people who had fairly serious disease that really affected their bodies, and they were unable to engage in genital relationships with others, some of these, especially older people, would talk about what healthy sex lives they have, and they've reconsidered their sex life as holding hands and cuddling. But what was interesting to us is that they wanted to say that is their sex life now. They didn't say, my sex life is done.
Yeah.
And now we just hold hands or cuddle. It was important for them to say that it has transformed.
Yeah.
And so you'd hear people talk about a range of ways of relating that they consider their sex life, and they'd say, I'm very satisfied with it.
Which is so beautiful and so needed. You know, I had this conversation on this podcast with Peggy Orenstein, which was so powerful to me because she was talking about sort of how social, how we don't even really have a definition of sex. Like, what is sex? So are two lesbians not having sex? Does that not count? Like, what's the, like, what is it? You know, in our minds, we have a very black and white idea of a man and a woman. And then you know, she works a lot within sort of with teens and young adults and on college campuses talking to people about sex. And there are people who are like, well, if it's anal, it's not sex. And it's like, really? But all of these, as a culture, we don't really even understand its definition. And so to hear it expanded out to include intimacy, you know, which I think is often forgotten for more physical manifestations of sex, is really interesting and probably would be a much healthier conversation, particularly for people who might become impaired, right? Like, it's not just about having an orgasm.
Absolutely. And I'm not a sex therapist at all, but some of my best friends are sex therapists. And I know that, you know, the goal for sex therapy is not to necessarily to restore mechanical functioning that might be broken. Be great if you can. But the goal is to find a way to have meaningful experiences.
Yeah.
And that may, yeah, and that may require some adaptation and exploration to find out what can be meaningful in the context of this body that I have now.
Right. What's meaningful and what is health sort of defining or health driving, and that intimacy, that touch, right? Like, that has to be, I'm sure that there's a lot of science to support that orgasm is really good for people's bodies, maybe even more so for women. But there also, I can't imagine that it's not overwhelmed by the evidence that shows that just pure touch alone and intimacy and eye gazing, and that's as healing as really getting your heart rate up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
You mentioned something else about we are not sure what counts as sex, and there's a whole diversity of activities and experiences. And, you know, when we began this work over 10 years ago to develop a set of measures that researchers and clinicians could use, one of the things that we did was to look at all of the different measures that were out there to measure sexual functioning and satisfaction in men and women. And there were a few good ones, but it was impressive how many measures were basically designed for sort of upper economic status, heterosexual married couples.
Yeah.
And the assumptions that were built into all the questions were so loud. And so one of the things that we really tried to do was to take a step back and say, how do we create a measurement system where we can allow people from all different backgrounds and different practices and orientations have their experiences reflected and tracked so that we can understand how their health problems are affecting whatever it is they're doing. And it took a lot of work to do that. It's not easy to put together a measure like that, but we're gratified that we're able to do that to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, think about how amazing would it be to have sort of an expanded understanding and to be able to have those conversations with kids, right? And teens. And because it is, even that definition of like, it's a mechanical act, that could end your life, but to make it an expansive conversation about like who gets to touch you and like really see you and be intimate with you, which is so much more sustainable, right? Through all of the phases of our life, through disability, through illness, through getting old, to have that conversation be the backbone around which we can all sort of understand our sex lives. Because I have two small kids and my husband loves it when I talk about this stuff on, but you know, it's like when you have two little kids, your sex life's not amazing, but our intimacy is, you know, and that's sustaining. But yeah, it seems like you could almost sort of forego a lot of these conversations about exactly what's physically happening if that doesn't become the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we heard from some people who talked about how their very intimate and open relationship with their partner that had a lot of communication beforehand was a tremendous resource to them as they moved through a disease that ended up taking away some of their physical abilities.
Yeah.
And so they were able to work through that, to be talking about what's happening and what else can be done, because there was that bedrock of intimacy and openness and
yeah.
trust. Some other people told stories that were a little bit different, where that wasn't in place before the disease hit. And now, not only have you got the disease affecting the parts of your body that you'd usually use to engage in intimate relations, but you don't have that means of talking with your partner to get through it now.
Yeah.
And it really is challenging. So trying to build that, as you say, build that at the front end, because you don't know what's going to be coming in the future, and having that in place so that this is something that can be talked about.
Yeah. Within your research groups, were there men who had that? Were they who had built that within their relationship?
We certainly heard stories from men who talked about what a strength their relationship was and how that foundation of openness and trusting and ability to just talk about what's going on with your intimate relations was extremely helpful to them.
And so what happens with women? Is it... Because women, it's so much less performative for us, right? Like there's no, but I'm assuming there can be an incredible variance in desire and a waning of desire and a not wanting to be touched. And I'm just projecting all the ways I might feel if I were ill. So what's the difference in conversation?
Well, obviously the way the body was affected is different because they're different
yeah.
bodies. But I would say that the themes were very similar. Maybe they differed in how much of one theme you heard in one group versus another. You know, and I'm making gross generalizations across our focus groups here, and my research colleagues would be very angry with me for doing that. But I would say among the men you'd hear more embarrassment about things not working
yeah.
than among the women. But certainly we heard plenty of absolutely heartbreaking stories told by women about how their disease and the treatments for the disease took a toll on their body and on their sexual lives and their relationships.
And was the toll on their sexual lives, was it sort of in their own ability to experience pleasure, or was it feeling like they were no longer sort of fuckable? Like what was it?
A whole range of things depending upon the disease. So, you know, for example, you know, certain treatments for cancer are going to make it so that the women can't get lubricated.
Mm-hmm.
There might be irritation from radiation treatments. There could be fatigue, incredible fatigue, especially during treatment. There could be, and this was an interesting one for us. After we did version one of our measure, we were talking to our clinical colleagues to say, what are we missing here? What's important about people's experience that we're missing? And a couple people said, you know, you're not asking anything about how their mouth is mm-hmm. impacted by the disease. And so oral discomfort during sexual activity,
mm-hmm.
because there are a lot of cases where people have all sorts of oral discomfort or oral dryness as a result of treatments they're going through.
Mm-hmm.
They've got head and neck cancer. they have dental problems. You know, the prevalence of dental issues in this country is huge. And no one ever asked those questions in a sexual functioning measure. And so we wrote some questions. And lo and behold, when we did some national data collection, we found there's quite a lot of people who are saying that they have significant oral discomfort and oral dryness during sexual activity. And depending upon who you are, that can really have a profound effect on your relations.
Yeah. I believe I read this in your research, but please correct me if I'm wrong. But this is typically, the other thing that's really interesting about your research is this typically doesn't happen. No one's being asked or talked to about their sex lives when their treatment is being, it's probably, I'm sure, with prostate cancer, obviously it's a sort of a well-known potential side effect, but it's not typical conversation to have with your doctor, right? Who's inquiring, like, how much sexual pleasure are you experiencing and what's happening with your sexual function?
Yeah, that is, you know, as part of our work, we spoke with a lot of clinicians to get their perspective. And there are certainly some clinicians who are really passionate about this work and they do talk to their patients. But there are a lot of clinicians who are not asking people about these things. And we hear a variety of reasons. You know, one is people just say, I don't have time. I've got about 7 minutes with this patient and there are higher things on the priority list for me. I've got to, you know, check to make sure the diabetes is under control. And so they just don't have the time. Others say, I don't want to ask about these things because I'm not sure what to do if they're having an issue.
Right.
And some people are just uncomfortable talking about it. A buddy of mine who's a doc said, as soon as someone mentions sex, my hand is on the doorknob. And so one of the things that we're hoping is that by creating these standardized sets of questions that could be used, you know, you could give those to people on an iPad in the waiting room, for example, and that might be easier for a clinician then to see where there's a problem and already have some language on the table for talking about this.
Yeah.
But some of these problems they've cited are real problems. If you only have an 8-minute appointment time, it's tough to get into a sensitive set of issues like this.
Yeah.
And a lot of doctors don't have the training to know what to do, or they think that nothing can be done,
right,
which is usually absolutely wrong.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Acer bag collection in its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Acer is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and the 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Acer collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
Is there any research around the importance of sort of sex and whether it's partner or not and its impact on health? Like, is it a stretch to wonder if sex isn't healing, or is that just too complex and too hard to measure?
The research of which I'm aware is mostly observational research. And so you're looking at correlations there, not,
yeah.
So it's hard to assign causation. But, you know, certainly from the conversations that my team and I have had with patients, I believe that it can be a very meaningful, significant part of someone's recovery or adaptation to their disease.
Do you also work with people's partners in terms of their relationship or what's happening on the other side? Or is it only looking at one side of the conversation?
That's a great question. The measures we developed were just for the patient, not the partner. But we absolutely have heard lots about the partners. And, you know, some of the trouble the patients are having really arising from problems their partner has. And so that's a very important area that, you know, I think would be good to do more systematic work in assessing. Because in situations with a partner, you really do have a dyad you're trying to work with.
Absolutely. Right? And what typically, like, and within the conversations in these groups, what emerges is that, like, partner sadness or fear or revulsion or annoyance, or like what typically seems to be happening?
I don't think there was a typical thing we heard. I think there's just all over the board. I mean, you just think of all the couples you know. It's hard to say what's typical of couples, right?
Right.
Every couple is so different, and that's what we heard, lots of different stories of some very, very moving stories by couples who were rock solid. You know, when we were listening to them, we were like, that's something to aim for, to have a relationship like that. Some people who actually seem to be strengthened through having to deal with the impact of their disease on their sex lives. And then other people who were really struggling because they couldn't communicate very well. There's a lot of speculation on the part of some people about what their partner must really think about me. Concern about not being attractive. You know, body image is a big issue, especially for people who have surgical alterations to their body. So just the whole gamut.
I think in any relationship, whether impacted by health or disease or age or disability, you know, at the core, it's like you have to create this a trust, or like, I guess, a foundational belief or love that like the attraction, which is hard, that the attraction can't be adulterated by outside factors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that attraction or desire, which of course is impacted by hormones and age and all of these other things, but that somehow like the person remains deeply lovable. And maybe that can best be expressed through intimacy and not bumping uglies. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, again, I think it comes down to like what are the measures and what qualifies as, and how can we enjoy where we are and not always be wondering if we're like doing enough?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you know, while we think it's very important to measure these impacts of the disease on the person's sexual functioning and satisfaction, and that should be done, you know, you're raising something, a risk in doing that we're establishing sort of metrics. You know, we're a society now that likes to keep score with everything. And so we need to be careful that the metrics that we're making available aren't interpreted as the only metrics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're really profoundly important aspects of people's intimate lives that we heard about that we cannot translate into a standardized questionnaire.
Yeah.
And it's always humbling to go and hear people's stories and be reminded of that. We did the best we could. We've got important things that we're assessing, but those aren't the only things. And so in addition to measuring these easier to measure things, it really requires conversations with people to also assess these more subtle, richer aspects of their experience.
Yeah. Like, do you ask like how frequently people like touch their partners or are touched by their partners in an intimate, potentially non-sexual way, or like hugs or kisses?
Yeah. Yeah. We've got questions about the frequency of those behaviors as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that would correlate. I interviewed a long time at the beginning of the podcast, Steven Snyder, who is the couples therapist who focuses on sex. But his point is that as a culture, we're far too focused on, again, the sexual act, but that you sort of fill your bank account by coming up behind your partner while they're washing dishes, or and you know, you hug them from behind and you give them a kiss, and there's no need for it to go any farther.
Yeah.
But that bit or that touch alone is so, it's a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not, you know, I think everyone's also had that experience of sort of like soulless, unanimated, mechanical sex, right?
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's like, how do you decide what's meaningful, right?
Yeah,
yeah. That seems, I guess, to be the work that you're after.
This is reminding me of a funny story about someone who participated in one of our studies. This was a study to try to figure out what's the best recall period for the measure. So when you're going to ask people questions, you know, do I ask you, how things been in the past 7 days or the past 2 weeks or the past month. What's the right recall period to use in our questions? And it really gets to how well can people remember what happened, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of the patients said, you know, if you want to know what's going on with me, you should ask about the past month. But it's another question about whether they can actually recall what happened to them over the past month. And so we did a study where we had men and women do a daily diary electronically every day, and it would ask if they'd had any sexual activity. If they said yes, then they had a number of questions asking them about how things functioned and felt, right? And they do that for 30 days, and at the end of the study, we give them a version of our measure that asks them to think back over the last 30 days and rate how things were, and then we look at how they matched up. And at the end of that study, there was an opportunity for people to just sort of write any thoughts or reflections they had. And one gentleman very eloquently described how he started this month-long study with a sense that he really had a wonderful sex life. He really enjoyed it. It was a big part of him. But these daily questions about the quality of his erections and things said really changed. By the end of the month, he was aware that he was starting to think of himself as this plumbing system, you know. And it was, you know, it was a very interesting point. And it was a good lesson to us that, you know, you have to be careful about what you're asking and when you're asking, because those are signaling to people what might be judged as most important.
Right.
And so that's why I say it's great to be measuring these things and to know that we also need to be talking, having those conversations about these other aspects of a meaningful intimate life.
Yeah. No, and it also just brings up the whole question of context, right? And timing and the way that we survey our lives and allowing for, you know, the ups and downs too, right? And that doesn't necessarily, it's like when you have a baby and the most helpful, persistent advice is like everything's a phase. And because you're like, I can't live like this anymore. And then suddenly it's your child transforms overnight. And it must be true of people's relationships too, right? And so, like when you,
sure.
If you look at any snapshot in time, it like has to be weighed against the larger story. And then we all have to obviously give ourselves permission within our relationships to know that desire will ebb and flow and illness will happen, whether chronic or
yeah.
short term and at various ages, and that it can't, those chapters can't be the whole story.
Right. They're just seasons.
Just seasons.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Kevin Weinfurt. You can find out more about his work at populationhealth.duke.edu. That's it for today's episode. If you have a chance, please rate and review. Hit subscribe to keep up with new episodes and pass it along to a friend. Thanks again for joining. I hope you'll come back for more. And in the meantime, you can check out goop.com/thepodcast.